It is 7:08 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert.
And I'm Antonia Yuhas.
What's shaking, Antonia?
Well, luckily not our home today. Poor Los Angeles, man.
What's shaking is state politics. Primary results out of Florida yesterday proved the pollsters wrong by double-digit margins on both sides of the gubernatorial race there. Representative Ron DeSantis, who's a Republican who had been backed by Donald Trump, had been pulling ahead in his race, but pulling ahead by single-digit margins in most polls. I think the most generous gave him a margin of victory of 12 points. He swept to a commanding victory, beating that best margin by over 10 points. On the other side of the ledger, the Democratic side of the ledger, a candidate, Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum, who had consistently been polling in third or fourth place with about 10% of the vote, just swept to victory. Significant, he is a Bernie Sanders-backed progressive. He would be Florida's first black governor if he wins victory. And clearly, the organization that has coalesced behind him capable of completely upsetting voter turnout models that are used by pollsters. So we have on the line John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation, who's been tracking that race and others. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. It's great to be with you both. And thank you for telling the worst joke ever at the start there about shaking.
Hey, man, come on. It's early.
Yeah. Start work at 7 a.m. There's a lot of bad jokes involved.
I am genuinely thanking you because I tell jokes like that all the time.
Okay.
I like him being put out.
Tell us about Andrew Gillum. What are his politics? What's his background?
He is a pretty remarkable figure. He's young. In fact, he was very active with the Young Elected Officials Network or Young Elected Officials Group on the progressive side of the ledger for a number of years. He's been mayor of Tallahassee, which is Florida's state capital city, a pretty progressive city. And he was a strikingly progressive mayor there, really standing out on a host of issues, defending immigrant rights, standing up on behalf of a lot of economic and social justice initiatives. When he got into the governor's race, an awful lot of people saw him as, a candidate who couldn't possibly go statewide because he was too progressive. I mean, that was the line on him. Now, that's a line they use on candidates all over the country, so it wasn't unique to Florida. But what Gillum did was to go out and meticulously build networks and coalitions to embrace issues as they arose and to throw himself into the thick of those fights. The best example is that after the horrific shootings in Parkland at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, he marched with the students, he rallied with the students, he embraced their calls for measures to address gun violence. He did so bluntly and without apology. Similarly, as issues of concern to immigrants have arisen, and obviously immigration is a huge issue all over the country, but especially in Florida, he embraced immigrant rights initiatives. He spoke bluntly about the damage that ICE does and the damage that the Trump administration's policies do. So he was very, very progressive. He was very, very active in building these coalitions out. And look, here's the bottom line. He drew an awfully lot of people into an excited and engaged coalition. And then, late stages of the campaign, drew an endorsement from Bernie Sanders, who came and campaigned actively and barnstormed around the state with Andrew Gillum. And I think you saw, something quite remarkable happen. He beat one of the best-known names in the state, Gwen Graham, who had been the front-runner in the race, a former congresswoman, a member of a very prominent Florida political family. And he beat a multimillionaire who spent incredibly heavily in the race. So it's quite a remarkable win.
But he beat them in a crowded field. He won with 35% of the Democratic primary vote. What are the indications that he's viable in a general election?
Well, he received a strong endorsement he has received strong endorsements from people who were backers of his foes in the primary. So, it's likely that he'll do quite well in pulling the party together. Of course, you will have, you know, that deep discussion that you always have after a primary like this about whether having a progressive candidate is a better idea than having a centrist. Now, here's the lesson from Florida over the last many years. Florida Democrats have again and again, really for the better part of two decades, nominated centrist candidates for governor. And they have won sometimes, but they have often lost. And they have often found that they ended up having a centrist candidate accused of being the biggest left-winger in the world, even if that candidate wasn't, not really being able to mobilize an energized base vote and not prevailing. That's what happened in 2010, again in 2014. And so what Florida progressives say, and I think it's a credible argument, we will see how it plays out, but what Florida progressives say is, no, what you need to do is boost the turnout. You need to have a candidate who can excite and energize new voters, get them to the polls, and, you know, prevail in November. And remember, Florida is an interesting state in this regard because it's got a constantly evolving, constantly growing population. And for instance, Florida has just seen a huge arrival of people from Puerto Rico who are American citizens who can vote immediately. They obviously need to be mobilized and organized. And so a campaign that is about mobilization, that is about organization, I think has some potential there that that might be hard to read in the polls, might be hard to see by a lot of pundits. And you, in a sense, referenced that as we came into this discussion.
What? How much are we seeing this play out in voting records thus far this season with progressive candidates? Are they doing that thing that we are hoping for, which is to bring new voters, people who previously were not voting, young people, people who found politics too conservative and not representative enough of them? Are they coming out to vote for the first time?
We're seeing quite a bit of pattern in that. Across the country, Democratic primaries have had boosted turnout, and that's in most states. Going back throughout this primary process, you'd see more people coming to the polls, and some evidence that you're getting younger voters, particularly a boost in turnout by African-Americans, Latinos, and other groups as well, demographic groups. And where what this has produced is a number of candidates who really are historic and people who are breaking boundaries. You have, in addition to Andrew Gillum, and just think about this for a moment, Andrew Gillum, African-American nominee for governor of Florida, a traditionally southern state, but one is, you know, not, it doesn't always fit all the models of a southern state. You have Stacey Abrams, Democratic nominee for governor of Georgia, you know, that's a classic southern state historically, obviously one that has also, you know, begun to break some of the traditional stereotypes and boundaries. You have Ben Jealous as the Democratic nominee for governor of Maryland, another African-American candidate, a former head of the NAACP. And then as you move out across the country and you look in races, you know, a little bit of down ballot races, you have people like Mandela Barnes, a 31-year-old African-American former state legislator and community organizer, labor rights organizer, nominated for lieutenant governor in Wisconsin and really part of a ticket out there or in Wisconsin that I think has energized a lot of folks. Again and again and again, you see breakthrough candidates, most of them younger, many of them people of color, many of them women. And so, yeah, there's something going on politically. It is boosting turnouts in many states. It's also producing candidates who, you know, come out of progressive traditions, candidates who maybe in the past might not have been the quote-unquote likely nominee. So we're going to have a real test in 2018. Can a different approach, an approach that is rooted in mass mobilization and getting people who don't usually vote to the polls in November, we're seeing some of it in the primaries, no question of that, but can you take that into a November election? If it works, then you're really seeing not just a transformation of our November politics, but really of the approach of the Democratic Party. And it's interesting this morning, that President Trump, who, whether you like him or not, follows politics incredibly closely, raced to attack Andrew Gillum on Twitter. I mean, he's already, you know, going after him. And why is that? Do you think that President Trump does that because he's, you know, thinks Andrew Gillum is weak and irrelevant and somebody not to pay attention to? I don't think so. I think actually President Trump and others recognize that one of the biggest threats to Republicans in 2018 is this idea of mass mobilization.
We're talking last night's primary results with John Nichols. He's Washington correspondent for The Nation. The most nationally consequential race on the Florida ballot in November is going to be the race for Senate. There's an incumbent Democrat, Bill Nelson, defending his seat against the Republican governor, Rick Scott. Nelson, very much the type of moderate Democrat who you were just describing as not having a great track record in Florida statewide races. Is there anything we can read into the turnout results in yesterday's primary that gives us some insight into what November looks like?
I think there's a few things that you can read into the results out of Florida from yesterday. Yeah, you did have a very strong Democratic turnout in the primary, and that's worthy of note. But I would also counsel that Bill Nelson is a unique figure in Florida. He does have a track record there as a, you know, somebody who's been elected for a long time. And frankly, yes, you are right, has crossed a lot of lines and built out his name recognition. He's going to face in Rick Scott an opponent who, frankly, has been one of the masters of this sort of ugly new politics of the last, decade. You know, Scott came up in the 2010 cycle, and he did so by spending an immense amount of money, spending at levels that are really unprecedented. And I think that is a factor that we have to put into the mix here. When we talk about mass mobilization, when we talk about, you know, having, you know, more people come to the polls, doing, you know, bigger things electorally, you still have the money power. Now, in the Democratic primary for governor, remember, the primaries for the Senate, Nelson and Scott were pretty well established from the start, and you know
Nelson was uncontested. Leaders. Scott was virtually uncontested.
Yeah, right. And so in those races, you know, you don't see a lot from there. But what was interesting was that in the Democratic and Republican primaries, you had roughly similar turnout in the gubernatorial primaries. So, you know, in each case, it's roughly around 1.5, 1.6 million. So it's very, very close there. But what was striking was that in both those primaries, the winner, DeSantis, who obviously had backing from Trump, and Gillum, who had backing from a lot of progressive groups, they won without as much of the money as opponents had. And so there is good evidence to believe that, you know, this impassioned base, again, being it on the right or the left, it can beat money. Now, as we go into November, that's going to be, you know, the big test. My sense is that Democrats who turn out to vote for a Bill Nelson or an Andrew Gillum are probably likely to vote the ticket, in part because of Donald Trump, who, you know, is such an easy person for Democrats not to like.
So you think having Gillum at the top of the ballot might give Nelson progressive mobilization coattails he wouldn't otherwise have?
I do. In fact, I think, you know, and also in fairness, that Nelson may bring some central Floridians, some, western, there's some parts of Florida that are more conservative. Democrats are somewhat more conservative. Nelson may bring some of those folks in. I've seen this happen before in politics. It's not always guaranteed because, of course, people can split ballots, and they have. But increasingly what we see a trend of is if you put together a ticket that draws from your different bases, but really can mobilize all of them, that's often the strongest approach. And I think it has, you know, we'll see a test of it in Florida. Again, I said in the piece I wrote on this that while there's an immense amount of excitement about Andrew Gillum's win, no one should imagine that, you know, this will be an easy race. I mean, Florida is a very tough state politically.
Rick Scott, the Republican, seems to be campaigning like a maniac, and he has the bully pulpit of the governorship. In particular, he's been courting displaced Puerto Ricans who've landed in Florida, and as you pointed out, are going to be eligible to vote in November. He's been to Puerto Rico 6 times, doing everything he can to signal he's willing to provide some of the relief the Trump administration hasn't.
Yeah. Rick Scott is no fool as regards politicking. And remember, Florida is a closely divided state, a state that one of those classic places that, you know, has gone back and forth on presidential races over the years. And so, you know, what you know is that if you can kind of move the margins a little bit, you can get places. Now, here's the interesting thing about it. You are absolutely right that Rick Scott, as the Senate candidate, is trying very, very hard to build out, you know, an appeal that goes beyond simply Trumpism, if you will. Now, DeSantis, the Republican gubernatorial candidate, ran the most all-in Trump campaign I have ever seen. He literally had, the president did endorse him in a contested primary when many leaders in the Florida Republican Party were backing another candidate, the State Secretary of Agriculture. Here's the interesting thing. DeSantis's website, if you go to the front page of the website, you wouldn't know whether he was running or Donald Trump. On the first page of his website, he had 3 pictures of Donald Trump. In his ads, Donald Trump was up front as much as DeSantis. And if you Google Ron DeSantis, what you get is Ron DeSantis, the first thing that comes up is a line that says, Ron DeSantis is fully endorsed by Donald Trump. Hmm. So if Puerto Rican voters, for instance, who've moved to Florida, or if other voters might be open to a marginally more moderate Republican, they're going to be looking at that ballot and seeing somebody on there who is all in with Trump. And to my mind, that could be a factor in causing folks, you know, just to kind of move away from that Republican side altogether.
Well, then before we let you go, let's turn to another recent piece that you wrote, speaking of Donald Trump, entitled Impeachment is the Cure for Our Constitutional Crisis, which is drawn from the foreword that you wrote to the book, The Constitution, The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump, The Constitution Demands It. And one sentence that I really liked in particular from the article is where you wrote, "Impeachment was never meant to be about crimes and punishments. It was intended as a remedy for the monarchical tendencies of men." Can you talk about why you wanted to write the foreword to this book and the case for impeachment against Donald Trump?
Sure. This book is authored by 3 very outstanding constitutional lawyers, including Ron Fine and John Boniface, who I think you may have been a pat on shows over the years. It is an important book because it makes a very solid, sober, mature case for why impeachment is not just an option, but really a requirement. But as the title suggests, the Constitution demands it. In moments where you have someone occupying a position, in this case the presidency, who is a threat not merely politically, but in a much deeper way, somebody who is doing harm to the country. And what they argue, of course, is that impeachment is a process, that the Judiciary Committee takes it up and investigates and is serious about this, doesn't do it casually. And I think that it's an important intervention, because at this point there's beginning to be a good deal of talk about impeachment, but people tend to be approaching it in a very casual manner, often in a very uninformed manner, thinking that there has to be proof of a crime, thinking that you have to have some sort of egregious, unimaginably egregious specific action. When in fact, what the founders were worried most about was an approach to the office, one that made the president so far above the rest of the people that it was effectively the presidency became a monarchy for 4 years, so the president himself a king for 4 years. And George Mason, one of the founders at the Constitutional Convention in 1787, probably summed it up best when he said that the impeachment power was the most important power to be kept in the Constitution, to be present there, because it answered the question of whether a president, in this incredibly powerful position that was being created, could essentially evolve into a king, could evolve into someone who was above the law, or as Mason suggested, that the person who was in this incredibly powerful position, who actually enforces the law or helps to develop the law, might also place himself above it. That's the danger that we're talking about, and that's why this is such an important issue. And the final thing is that it's also important to understand that impeachment was never understood as something that would be a constitutional crisis, as it's often referred to by its critics. It was always understood as a cure for a constitutional crisis, an answer for a crisis that had already developed. And my sense is that in coming months, we will come to understand the necessity of impeachment. So I'm glad to have been a part of this book.
Quickly, John Nichols, because we're almost out of time. What's your diagnosis on why so few Democratic office holders are saying anything about pressing forward with impeachment, even after the president became an unindicted co-conspirator in a federal felony guilty plea?
Well, I think that political parties on both sides play games with impeachment. They see it as a third rail that might be risky or dangerous. They fear that it might mobilize people who support a sitting office holder. There's all these political calculations that go into it. And one of the things that I learned, I wrote a book many years ago on impeachment, and obviously worked on this forward for this book. In many years of researching impeachment, one of the things I found is that the best way to go at it is not to make political calculations, but to simply, look at the core issues and address them. The people will come along. They invariably do. But politicians rarely have confidence in the people, making judgments based on the information that they're given. So you see Democrats being very, very cautious about this. Although I will counsel that a growing number of Democrats are speaking up, and it was striking that Beto O'Rourke, the Texas Senate candidate, in one of the really most fascinating races in the country, a very close race by evidence of the polls, when asked about impeachment, said he would support it. Yeah. And so I do think that there are some folks stepping up.
John Nichols, that's all the time we have. Always a pleasure to speak to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. And I want to correct something. That joke at the start was brilliant.
Thank you.
John Nichols is Washington correspondent for The Nation.